Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails in a moment, but we've got something important I want to do, and that is talk to Dr. Tyler Cowen, who insists that I call him Tyler. He's the author most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. And when I saw this, I thought, Dr. Cowen, I have to know what the premise is, and I looked into the book, and I thought, this is really interesting, because I see myself in a lot of the description that you've written of this American population in repose. So, as I understand the thesis, when Americans, well, when people, Europeans mostly, came to this continent first, these were adventurers. These were people willing to take big risks and go out and take chances and get the rewards that came with it. And today, you posit an American class that, they want comfort. They want to move to a neighborhood of people like them. They want to live in a house that is, you know, a house that they can afford, and they want to be around people who are like them, and they effectively have eschewed any kind of risk-taking, and you think that in the long term, this is going to be really bad for America.
That's right. It's taking away our dynamism. We move across state lines less often. We medicate ourselves much more. We hardly ever let our children play outside. We regulate our economy too much, and overall, we care too much about security and safety.
Now, whose problem is this to fix? And the reason I ask that is I'm also one of those people who's averse to the idea of having the government do social engineering. I mean, I guess I'd accept that, you know, the offer of the deductibility of mortgage interest on your home is a little bit of social engineering to encourage people to buy houses rather than to rent housing. But other than that, I would like the government to stay out of my business. So how do you go about getting an entire population to say, I want to move to a neighborhood where I'm a bit uncomfortable, or maybe I'm a little, you know, out of place, and I'll take a job doing something that I'm, you know, I'm not necessarily all that sure I'm competent at. Is that what you're getting at?
I'm trying to give people that sense of urgency. I don't see government as the solution. In part, government's part of the problem. We have a government that way back when needed only 7 years to put a man on the moon. These days, we can't build a bridge in 7 years. Sometimes we can't even rename a bridge in 7 years. Our government has become more and more about spending money to protect people.
Yeah, and so how do we move away from that? And, I mean, and is, say, Donald Trump, who promises to get rid of 2 federal regulations for every 1 new one that is adopted, is this one of the ways that will work, or is that going to fail as well?
I believe that will fail. So bureaucrats will simply relabel what counts as one regulation. They'll take a whole bunch of regulations and just call it one, and that won't have much effect. Keep in mind, Trump himself has promised not to touch entitlement spending. I'm not sure he will succeed in getting this country to spend more on research and development. Trump is promising a lot of change, but I think ultimately a lot of his policies will prove defensive, and his rhetoric is that of looking backwards rather than forwards.
It's
not a grand new vision. It's make America great again.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Cohen. Yeah, Tyler Cohen is with me, PhD and New York Times bestselling author most recently of The Complacent Class. Well, let me ask you about one specific thing from the president's speech last night. He talked about the fact that federal regulations now currently make it very difficult for pharma companies to be able to bring new drugs to market that might save people's lives or improve their lives. Now, I'll accept your point that we're a far more medicated society than we probably ought to be, and certainly than we used to be. But if he's successful at rolling back some of those regulations, doesn't that in itself, in the microcosm, say we're going to let pharma companies take greater risk because they will have greater rewards by being able to get these drugs to market quicker?
I was very happy to hear Trump say that. I do feel that's an area where he has a good chance of being effective. I'm hopeful he'll appoint someone very sophisticated to head the FDA. But even there's a problem that most of the staff at the FDA does not have the same incentive. Their incentive is to play it safe and slow down or delay the development of new drugs so they don't get blamed. So whether Trump and his appointee can overcome all of that bureaucratic inertia, I'm hopeful. I'm delighted he's made it an issue, but we haven't yet seen the change come.
Tyler, is there a way to re-engineer the way the government bureaucracies work so that there is an incentive? Because you're the economist, not me, but you know that if you go to work in a private sector company, the usual incentive is get products to market, get things done, because when things stop happening, money, revenue stops flowing into the company, and everybody knows that my paycheck is dependent on the company doing well. But as you say, in a government bureaucracy, your paycheck may be dependent on making sure that you never, ever, ever make a mistake. And if you say, well, well, then we can take forever to approve a drug because that way I will reduce the incidence of mistakes and increase my longevity in my federal job.
In my lifetime, I've seen our government become a big insurance company. One can debate what should be the proper size of government, but for any given size, I think we should spend more on infrastructure, more on research and development, more on dynamism, and less on simply protecting everyone's income and health care in every way possible. In the long run, we'll actually be much safer if we're dynamic. That's the counterintuitive point.
I get that point, but Tyler, when you say we should spend more, the we could be government, we could be the private sector, the we could be individuals. Which we are you talking about investing more in?
All of those we's.
Including government.
We all need to make that decision. And ultimately, it will come from the citizens. Government does actually respond to some extent to what voters want, and voters have asked for more complacency. That's part of our problem. We get the government we deserve all too often.
Well, I've heard that 100 times, but do we get the government we deserve when the people of Alabama, say, send a state a member of Congress back to Capitol Hill, and he says, well, if the Pentagon's going to make a new airplane, I want the tires or the wings or something else to be made in Alabama. And I want to make sure that some of those jobs come to my district or even to my state if I'm a senator. That actually makes sense for his state. It may not make sense for the whole country, and it may lead to the Pentagon building a lot of things that they don't actually need. But how do you get the rep from Alabama to say, I'm going to do what's good for the whole country, even if it works against my own district?
I think voters have to actually demand true fiscal conservatism, which we do not have right now. There's still a sense we can pay for anything by just issuing more debt. And if that's your attitude, you'll let all kinds of little things slip because you'll say, oh, we don't really have to pay for this right now. Again, I think we're very far from making the changes we need to. It requires a whole new cultural mindset. It's not just a question of some political movement or some individual leader. But that's what I think has to happen. People have to see it as an urgent matter that we stop wasting money through government, not just a question of rhetoric.
You mentioned reforming the entitlements. I agree with you. Two-thirds of the federal budget is made up of entitlements. But how do you go about doing that when it means someone's grandmother's Social Security check is going to get cut, or maybe even denied if it's means-tested?
The way it's most likely to happen is that people who are older will keep the benefits they have been promised, but at some age level, the deal has to be different. And again, I think Trump has actually moved us away from that kind of realization. The Republicans in Congress have a clearer sense that that needs to be done. Trump, in essence, is telling people we don't have to do it.
Well, but let me ask you something. The Republicans, I've never thought the Republicans got all. I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative, I think. Maybe after I read your book, I'll decide that I'm not. I'm a person in repose. But, Tyler, when President Bush, you know, way back in the day, said we need to reform Social Security, both his own party and the opposition party said, no, we're not going to do that. And if we had started the reform, you know, 15 years earlier, we'd at least be better off than starting it today or next year or next decade.
I fully agree. The problem there was the voters. Keep in mind, the Bush administration, when Republicans controlled all branches of government, they increased government spending at a higher pace than had the Democrats. So for me, it's not really a party matter. Both parties end up bad when they're in control. I think it's ultimately a matter of the cultural fabric of this country needing to change.
I'm talking to Dr. Tyler Cohen, who holds the Holbert Harris Chair in Economics at George Mason University. He's a New York Times bestselling author, most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails, 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Radio 1120 KPNW.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your emails. talk@LarsLarson.com. You can also call in later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Follow us on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. I'm speaking with Dr. Tyler Cohen, who's insisted I call him Tyler, who is an economist at George Mason University. He is a best-selling author and most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. Now, let me ask you about one of the central premises of the book, and that is that human beings today, in today's society, American society, say, I'm going to gravitate toward what is comfortable. And I told you I saw myself in that description to some extent. I'm going to buy the house that I think is best for my family, and it's likely to be in a neighborhood that is full of people that are similar to me in a lot of ways. And you say this leads to bad things like segregation. How does it lead to it, and is that necessarily a bad thing if it's done by my choice and the choice of other Americans?
Each individual wants to live next to like-minded others because they enjoy it or in some way benefit from it. But I think when everyone in society does it, it becomes a collective action problem. But there's too little mobility, too little mixing, too little dynamism. It's harder for poor people to rise through the ranks for the most part. And part of that is because it's so expensive to try to move into Manhattan or San Francisco to get a better job. So I think we're failing our nation when we do this so completely and cement it in with government-backed zoning and regulation. To me, it's a worrying sign. The older, more dynamic America truly was in some ways more mixed by income and education, and that was healthy.
Tyler, I worry that your prescription here, your diagnosis of our problem, is going to lead to governments who start to talk about things like inclusive zoning, which is even more government. I mean, I'm sure you've run into the idea, but it's currently under discussion in my neck of the woods in Oregon and Washington, where government leaders say, we will force the mixing. We will insist that developers build housing of various kinds in which the doctor and the lawyer and the engineer are going to live next to the bus driver or the garbage man or the waitress, because we're going to tell the developer that he has to provide that housing specifically for people of lower economic status to be able to live there. But I'm not sure, Doc, does it actually happen that if the waitress or the garbage man lives next door to the doctor, that necessarily increases his economic fortunes?
I don't want to force anything, but the net impact of force has been regulations restricting what developers can build in cities. So I would just like to do more deregulation of building. Much of Texas has fairly deregulated building and building codes, and there's more mixing in Texas, and a lot of people have moved there for cheaper housing for that reason. And that's worked quite well. Texas has become a much wealthier, better-off state. So it can be done in a way that works, and I think it's less coercive than what you see in Portland or Manhattan or San Francisco or Beverly Hills.
And when you talk about segregation, are we talking about classical segregation, that is either economic segregation or even racial segregation?
It's both of those. More and more, it's also by education. So some parts of America, people don't know anyone who voted for Donald Trump. Other parts of America, well, you can drive from one coast to another without going through any county that favored Hillary Clinton in the election. That, to me, is amazing.
It is amazing.
In Washington, D.C., I know people will say, how could Trump have won? I don't know anyone who voted for him.
At that point, you start to quote Pauline Kael, right, on Nixon, saying, I don't know how he won. Nobody I knew voted for him. But doesn't that suggest that some of the people who live on the two coasts are living in their own little protected bubbles and don't realize there's a great big America out there that they've never visited?
On both sides, this is a growing problem. And we don't understand each other as well, and we're shocked by what people who think differently believe. Really shocked. This, to me, is disturbing. This was not the case in the 1960s or 1950s in the United States.
So how do we get back to that, and how do we do it without having the government issue it as an edict, which, you know, it likes to do or has liked to do up till now, and we'll see what happens under the Trump administration?
Well, keep in mind, my book is mostly a diagnostic, pointing out how bad the problem has become. I think we're so far down the path of our problems, you know, our debt, our complacency, our high level of regulation. I don't think there's any way to just undo those in a few years. And in the last chapter of the book, I predict, you know, the way we'll, quote-unquote, get out of it is by having some kind of crack-up. So I would love to, you know, be able to set things straight. But I think, frankly, our chance for that was maybe in the 1990s. And right now we're going to see a decline in the quality of our governance and a lot of problems just, you know, paying the bills of our government.
When you
I don't think we're going to get out of it.
Tyler, when you say a crack-up, how would you see something like that coming about? How would it exhibit itself?
Imagine some international crisis arising, and I don't have a particular prediction, but you could imagine which parts of the world, right, North Korea, the Middle East, and our government not having the resources, the flexibility, the credibility or support of the American public to do what it needs to do. That's the most likely scenario.
All right. Are there other ways that private sector institutions, even companies that employ people, might help solve this problem? Because I know that there are tech companies that love to let their own employees become entrepreneurs. And then again, that requires that you work at a tech company. But I think it probably happens more out of public view, even in smaller companies, where the boss says, yeah, I'd love to see you come up with an innovation and make $1 million. Go for it.
Sure. I think tech companies have been a big hero in this story. Not enough of our economy is like the tech companies. They also encourage mixing and different perspectives, and they tend to be quite tolerant places. So I'm all for that. You know, I see the level of trust in our private sector increasing and the level of trust in our government decreasing. And that, to me, indicates something that, you know, maybe it's the private sector that will solve some of the problems here when eventually that does happen.
I still can't get past the impression that I don't see that there's a problem with people deciding to live near people who are like them, always with the option that if they say, no, I want to live in a more mixed neighborhood, that they can. They simply pick a similar economic level neighborhood, but one with people in it who are not like them, educationally, racially, or otherwise.
But keep in mind, it's not a voluntary process. So people are moving to these areas, and then they use governments to pass laws, which in essence keep out people who are different, even if that's not always the explicit intent. So I would be all for what would result from voluntary mixing, but right now it's anything but voluntary. We don't have school choice. Public schools create a huge lock-in effect. They make homes in good school districts much more costly. They make it harder for people to have reasonable commutes and good jobs. And I think the upward ladder of American mobility right now is somewhat broken.
So in that way, the prescription that the Trump administration has embraced with the appointment of Betsy DeVos as education secretary does fit into a reform model for you, right? That she wants she wants school choice, and the president mentioned school choice last night.
I like the ideas of Betsy DeVos. As you know, in this country, schooling is mostly state and local, but I do think it's useful to have a spokeswoman for school choice at the federal level. But Betsy DeVos, on her own, even with the help of Trump, cannot do it.
His book is called The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest of the American Dream. He is Dr. Tyler Cohen. Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you on the program, and congratulations on the book.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.